for the beer radio you've been looking for. This is the show that dispels myths, tackles the toughest topics, and makes no apologies for geeking out on beer. Hosted by two guys that drink before they think, Jamil Zainashev and John Palmer. This is Brew Strong.
Hey, howdy, hey, my brewing brothers and sisters.
Good day, good day.
Yeah, we're back. Brew Strong. This is happens every, I don't know, so often.
Every fortnight, as I understand. Fortnight.
Yeah. And it's live. We are live in the studios in Pacheco, in the rainy Pacheco studios this time of year.
Yes, rainy, fly-filled.
Yeah. Right. The big piles of poo that are in the studio are attracting flies.
No, the beer.
Oh, no. That
open
was,
open
was,
containers of beer. That's the thing.
That was the people listening. No, no.
I think Palmer's become really proud of his new Australian friends. In the last episode, he made us convert everything to the metric system.
Right.
And
right.
This episode, he used Fortnite.
Fortnite.
A bunch of good mates down there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I like it. Taking care of your brothers.
Taking care of your brothers. Yes, yes. What I was going to say is, if
train
you get a chance, you're listening live. Which you can do. All these shows are done live. This is all taped and edited and then broadcast. We do podcasts these after we do them live, but you can listen to them live. And the way to do that, go to the www.thebrewingnetwork.com, and you can listen live there if you're a podcast listener. It's real easy. There's a little bit of software to download, but it doesn't do anything weird to your system and doesn't start generating ads or anything weird like that. And you can also chat live. You can participate in the show. We answer some questions at the end of the show, and we
encourage you to go get in the chat room and
right,
ask us
right.
questions.
And there's other people in the chat, like-minded like you, and they'll answer some questions or just a good time had by all. And that's available to you as well from thebrewingnetwork.com. Go to the chat, click that chat button on the homepage. While you're there, take a look in the store. The store helps us keep this programming flowing. So you can get really cool hop grenade shirts.
Yep.
I don't think there's any Brew Strong shirts right there right now, but that's Justin. He's a little threatened by the show, but that's okay. That's okay. You can get a hop grenade shirt, which I really like. I wear it to pretty much every beer event I go to. I'm either wearing a Brew Strong shirt or a hop grenade shirt.
Yep.
I think I did my keynote speech in Australia wearing a hop grenade shirt. The numbers in the store right currently all active. Get to the store, get yourself a shirt before they're gone really quick. There's Brewing Classic Style signed by both John Palmer and Jamil Zainashev. There are next week you're going to see some glassware, BN glassware. I love these. I'm going to start dumping a lot of my other glassware so I can have these at
home. Are nice looking glasses and they're good size too.
Yeah, my wife you like that it's a good size. Huh? Okay.
That's right.
My wife
good in the hand.
My wife only allows me a certain amount of glassware, and I'm telling you, I'm going to just dump a bunch of glassware to start putting these in there. I like these. These are very nice. I like the style of glass. I love the logo, of course.
People want to make sure I didn't get those tumbler glasses, the iced tea glasses.
Yeah.
No,
a lot of people think are standard beer glasses, but they're not.
No, these are I really love these. One, for...
What do you call these? Like they're not...
I call them Pilsner glasses, but I don't know
that
that's
their
name.
No, they're not Pilsner glasses. No, Pilsner people assume is the tall one that flares out consistently all the way to the top.
Mm-hmm.
This is German...
Not the tulip glass.
No, tulip glass has a bulge in it.
You'd get a Helles served to you in this if you were in Munich.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think this is a great all-around beer glass. I'm so glad you chose this one.
Great.
The English tulip glass is a very good overall, but when you tend to go lagers, I like something a little narrower so it doesn't get quite warm. But this still has a good, the top closes in a little bit to help trap some of the aromas, concentrate the aromas. Overall, probably one of the best choices.
Yeah.
It's seriously.
My favorite
not
style
just
glass, too.
Yeah. Right. It's one choice.
Yeah, I bought
year.
A bunch of the
good.
Gordon Biersch glasses. because they were this style.
Same, and that's where I just stole it from Grand
Right.
Beer. I love that style.
If you try drinking a lot of different beers out of that style of glass,
yeah.
This is your best all-around glass. It really works for almost every style of beer. There's some that you need a thinner glass with more of a bulbous shape at the bottom so you can warm it more.
Mm-hmm.
But the majority of beers will do really well in this glass. I think that's a fantastic choice. And
available this week.
Yeah, there you go. You know, we talked, previously you talked about how I was going to Nashville. I went to Nashville for the Music City Brew-Off.
That should have been a good conference.
It was. And I'll tell you, the people there were fantastic. You know,
great bunch of brewers down there. Great group
of folks. I'll tell you, I think no offense to the professional brewers there, they're doing a great job. But the homebrewers there, kicking some ass.
I don't doubt it.
I went to this guy's bunker. They called the bunker. And, a very impressive brewing setup with, like, a lounge and, you know, stuff. I mean, puts anything to shame that I've seen in most people's places, except maybe Doc. And they served me some fantastic beers. One of the beers was this Doppelbach that I could find nothing wrong with.
Wow.
I mean, the only thing they're wrong with is my glass kept getting empty. So there must have been a hole in the glass or something like that. And I was exhausted. I didn't get much sleep the night before. I got like 2 hours plus the plane trip. So, you know, and I still stayed till like 2:30 in the morning, you know, sucking down glass after glass with this Doppelbach. That was one of their late members. And I can't remember his name now. It's just they told me, make sure you remember his name, which was Ed. I don't know. They'll call me and let me know, and I'll mention it again on another show. But
fair enough.
There was and one of the things was there was a guy there who was like the tasty of
that
Nashville.
Club. Oh,
yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
You know, that was the first place that I started to realize that every beer brewing group has its own tasty.
Yeah,
it's got its own tasty, and I think our tasty is the best,
mm-hmm.
but. I was really, impressed with this one guy. It seems like it was years ago, so I can't remember anybody's name, and I feel so bad about it. But I could see the guy's face. I'm good on faces. I'm really bad on names. But this guy, he had me try several of his beers, and each one, I'm like, oh, wow, that's really tasty. That's really good. I mean, this is how Tasty got his name. Tasty beers, and. I was very impressed overall, and one of the things about this event is that the proceeds go to charity, to a child's charity.
Hmm.
So they're not taking in money so they can have some drunken bus tour.
Right.
They're not taking in money so they can buy more equipment for the club brew house. They're
right.
taking the money
right.
so they can give it away to benefit people that. Are less fortunate than themselves. And I think, if everybody, I don't want to get on the clubs, but if you got a sizable club that can put on an event like that,
yeah.
you ought to think about, donating the proceeds to charity.
Yeah.
Do something good out of it.
I think a lot of clubs, they figure let's kind of operate as a nonprofit and mm-hmm. let's break even, keep the costs low for people who want to participate.
Right.
But at the same time, I mean, you and I both know that. I mean, brewers, very generous people, very, with their time and so on. And, they don't mind, kicking in a little bit more to, attend these things and
even with the bad economy,
yeah.
More time than ever to contribute to the charities. I know it's rough. When everyone's flush and contributing to, one tragedy or another,
mm-hmm.
it's the day-to-day tragedies in life, that children suffering from diseases and things like that
yeah.
don't get a lot of attention, that something like the folks in Nashville are
yeah.
doing a really spectacular job. I was very pleased to attend, and I was very very touched by this group of individuals. They they really have their heads and their hearts in the right places, and very proud to have been part of that whole event. I went there. I spoke at dinner after everybody had 5 beers and a delicious dinner.
Were you supposed to?
Yeah.
Okay.
They asked me to, and I'm like, well, And, you know, people nodding off in the crowd. You know how I speak. Ah, nobody wants to listen to that. And, you know, then I was just exhausted by the travel and stuff. I can't go east. I can go west. You know, evidenced by our Australia trip, I can go west. I can go west with the best of them, baby. But east I can't do. But I had a great time, and it was a great group of people, and I think that, you know, we should all strive to be so kind and generous in our lives. That's a great thing. Those guys should be real proud. All right, today we're talking about malt analysis.
Yep. What do you get out of these malt analysis sheets?
Right. So if you're buying your grain a pound at a time from the homebrew store, you may not ever see these, but every lot of malt has a malt analysis sheet. And this is, you know, mainly for the bigger brewers to, you know, they're worried about, you know, one point in, you know,
extraction
the
efficiency.
Right. Is going to affect them, you know, $10,000 or something.
Yeah, it's their bottom line. Right.
So that's real critical. But, you know, how does that play into, you know, the average home brewer? What do you do? What really matters? Right. So I got an email from Bobby. And he said, hey, Jamel, I'm fairly new to all grain brewing. I'm trying to dial in my mash efficiency based on what I suspect the PPPG,
right,
of my malt is. I'm using the default values in ProMash right now. So this guy, you know, he knows what he's doing. He's paying attention. He knows that it's PPPG, not PPG or anything like that. I'm using the default values in ProMash right now. My question is, how do you determine the PPG value of the particular malt you use? Do you plug in the malt analysis into ProMash, or do you just use the default values for each particular malt? I'm wondering if it varies from each maltster. For example, is all domestic two-row always 1.036? Just wondering what your thoughts on this are. So, what I thought we'd do today is we've got Bob Hansen.
From Breeze Malting.
Breeze Malting. And you're quite the expert on malt analysis as well, as I
am. Well, I sat at Bob's knee for quite some time. Bob and
well,
Dave
what's
Cuskey.
That got to do with malt analysis?
It took me a while to figure this stuff out, too. But
No. But we both know Bob real well. He's a wonderful person, real humorous. I actually hung out with him at the hop school up at Hop Union. And he's a wonderful person, very knowledgeable, and he handles you know, the production of extract at Breeze Malting, so he knows quite a bit about what we're talking about.
Yep, professional brewer too.
Yeah, professional brewer, award winning professional brewer as
true.
Well.
Yeah,
great guy, and we're gonna have him here, luckily, to talk about malt analysis and everything that means. So what we're gonna do? We're gonna take a short break. When we come back, we'll get together with Bob, you. Listener questions.
And some body.
some body. Yeah. All right.
That's what that said, right?
Bobby.
Oh, Bobby. Right.
All
okay.
Right. Yeah. Be back after this.
Brew right. Brew smart. Brew strong. This is Brew Strong.
Williams Brewing is your online resource for prompt delivery of quality home brewing supplies. Since 1979, Williams Brewing has offered the finest equipment and freshest ingredients and the best customer service in the business. Cut hours off your brewing sessions by using one of their 11 varieties of famous Williams malt extract. Their Williams German Pils is mashed with pure German Moravian two-row barley malt for a light blonde color and malty crispness you just can't get from other extracts. Or check out their unique fermenters, draft beer equipment, bottling aids, and more. They even have their own line of precision hydrometers. Go to williamsbrewing.com to browse their vast selection and enter promo code BREW at the order checkout for $5 off your next order over $50. Orders placed by 3 p.m. ship the same day. Again, go to williamsbrewing.com and enter promo code BREW at checkout for $5 off your next order. Brewing is easy the Williams way.
What have you gotten out of a vial of White Labs yeast?
WLP-001, Cal Ale, baby!
23, Burton Ale.
008, East Coast Ale.
Cal Common, WLP-810.
It's gonna be WLP-400 with beer!
I got a sweet hoodie for my vial.
Huh?
White Labs, your source for great brewer's yeast, would like to invite all homebrewers to join the White Labs Customer Club. Redeem your empty vials for great White Labs merchandise and products. Free yeast, glassware, t-shirts, baseball caps, sweatshirts, polo shirts, and you won't believe what you'll get for 5,000 vials. Members also receive a newsletter packed with White Labs updates and facts, interviews with professional brewers, brew your own clone recipes, beercook.com recipes, and customer club stories. The White Labs Customer Club. Save your vials and get in the club. White Labs. It's all in the vial.
Live. Beer Radio. The Brewing Network.
The Brewcasters.
If you're just starting, don't be discouraged by all this stuff. Exactly. It's so easy.
Just throw it together.
Put some sugar and some water and some yeast in there.
Yeah.
Network.
Learning to brew has never been so disgusting. This is Brew Strong.
All right, we're back. We're talking about malt analysis and what it means to the home brewer.
Sure.
And I've got here with me my partner in crime, John Palmer. And on the phone, we have one of my favorite people in brewing and a great friend to home brewers, Bob Hansen from Breeze Malting. You there, Bob?
Yeah. Hi, Jamil. Thanks for the great intro.
Well, thanks. Well, and speaking of great intros, I was just remembering, and I know people complain about me waffling on for too long, but I think the first time I met Bob was at one of the homebrewer conferences. Bob spent a lot of time coming out to the homebrew conference in the U.S. and presenting some great information and being available for homebrewers, which is really nice of him. But I think the first time I met him, I was like, okay, you know, I got to introduce you for this topic. And I was going to introduce the speaker, and I said, I thought I'd set up something. I don't remember how we got into this, but he was like, well, you know, I think you pretty much left it up to me. But I told him, I said, I think I want to do something a little bit unusual. And Bob was cool with it, and I introduced him as the person to set the solo crossing of the Antarctic record. Speed record, and he basically did it with malt extract as his human food source, right?
Source of fuel. I remember that. It's always good to start with a joke. So.
Well, the funny thing was, everybody in the crowd totally bought it, I think. I mean, there was maybe one or two people that already knew you that knew you didn't do that, but everybody else was like, oh, wow, dude knows how to work some skis, you know?
Great.
That was great. And people to this day probably still believe you hold the solo crossing of the Antarctic record.
Yeah, you know, I think you're just a bit too dry in your delivery.
I think that's it. Yeah. Probably. Anyways, so you're always one of my favorite people, and I really love seeing you at the conferences, and it's so good of you to join us here to talk about malt analysis, because I know you know a lot about malt as well as John Palmer here. So let me kick it off. You know, listener was asking, you know, what do I do, you know, as far as, you know, particular malt, you know, what number do I key in off of this malt analysis into Pro Mash? You know, is it really important to do that, or should I just pick with stick with a default value? How much do these values range on the malt analysis? Is if I pick one intermediary value, is that okay, or should I worry about, you know, whether it's a few points one way or the other? Let's kick it off with Mr. Palmer here.
Okay, well, I guess I'll start off by kind of defining the PPPG, or points per pound per gallon. Number that, you know, that of course that's not a value or a term that's used in professional brewing, but it's one that homebrewers use because we're used to reading hydrometers as opposed to refractometers typically. And what it means is how many pounds of malt extract or malt do you put into a volume of water or to make a wort, and what gravity do you get from it. So this brewer was asking, you know, with a particular malt, is domestic two-row always a 1036? That is, in other words, 36 points per pound of malt per gallon of wort. And Bob, I think you can probably take it from there. You know, how similar are two-row base malts across the spectrum like this?
Well, you know, they're all pretty similar. You really got to look at what kind of accuracy are you expecting, or what kind of accuracy do you need. I think a lot of the value in the brewing calculations are really for, you know, rough value and getting your recipe approximately right. You know, when you start to worry about the variation in them, I think it's usually the bigger brewers who are really measuring their brew house efficiency and, you know, gaining or losing hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars, based on the errors or the differences between one batch of malt and their ability to properly capture it.
Yeah.
Small brewers, you know, I'm not sure it has as much meaning other than it's always good to understand your efficiency. Two rows will, in general, vary not only from, supplier to supplier a little bit, but also they're going to vary based on breed and, more importantly, crop year, where you'll see things like some years, if there's a real bad crop, you'll get high proteins and resultant low extracts.
So this is something that's critical to you at Breese, because you want to have a real consistent product so people year in and year out can expect your extract to provide the same specific gravity and, you know, the same fermentability and all that, and you're totally on top of this, I know, right? That's something that's a given. But in the homebrew setting, it's probably more critical, you know, the amount of your mash to water ratio, or, you know, how fast you're sparging, or pH, or any of those other things. Is that true, or am I oversimplifying?
Well, I mean, in general, I think you're right. You know, the yield of a malt, it's not going to vary so greatly that I think at a home brewing level you're going to need to adjust your recipes. And most recipes that are written that you see from home brewers are just written based on pounds of malt. They don't ask you to take into account, you know, the yield. I would say that from a home brewing point of view, and actually even from a big brewing point of view, how efficient you are at getting that extract out through good sparging or you know, good mashing techniques is maybe more important to what you get out than the actual, you know, malt analysis that is what the malt gives under ideal conditions. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I guess one thing I kind of forgot to mention was the conversion from gravity points to the kinds of numbers that we see on a malt analysis sheet. The most typical number that we'll see on a malt analysis sheet to describe the amount of extract we get from a malt is what's called the extract fine grind dry basis, and that's a percentage by weight. If you take a standard such as sucrose or white table sugar, that contributes 46 pounds per point per gallon, or in other words, you dissolve a pound of that into water to make 1 gallon of sugar solution, and that will have a hydrometer gravity of 1.046. We ratio that against the extract fine grind dry basis number of, say, 80% for a two-row brewer's malt. And so 80% of 46 works out to about 36 or 37. And that is a number that we would see in ProMash and other brewing software, is like the maximum extract we could extract from that malt, and there we have and from that point we look at our brewer's efficiency. You know, how much of that maximum extract does our system or does our process yield, and typically our efficiency would be like 70-75% in the homebrewing world. Is that right, Bob?
Yeah, that sounds about, you know, to be. I mean, I think most homebrewers are satisfied with that type of efficiency. And I think you summed it up pretty well in terms of you know, the fine grind dry basis being the one number that's important. I think actually, I mean, quite realistically, it's more the as-is numbers that are truly more meaningful for the brewers, the ones that take into account the moisture. And the one that usually is the most meaningful is the coarse grind as-is. That typically tells you the type of yield you should expect to get out of a grain.
Yeah, so like fine grind dry basis is your theoretical, but your realistic maximum is the coarse grind as is, you're saying.
That's correct. Except for the dry basis is actually, it removes, it's really just a calculation, and it removes the variance of the effect of fluctuating moisture. And really all those yield numbers, it's kind of crazy that as a maltster you're actually supplying four standard numbers for yield. And maybe to just break those down quickly so that homebrewers can understand why there's four of them and really what they mean and how they're relevant. There's two main types. There's a coarse grind and there's a dry basis and as is, and then there's a fine grind and again dry basis and as is. And the coarse grind is it's actually, if you were to look at a coarse grind, and I think John, I think there's some pictures of what a coarse grind looks like from a lab grind in your book, if I remember correctly.
That's right.
It's actually what a home brewer would consider a very fine grind. The grain's pretty busted up, but it's representative of the probably as fine of a grind as a brewer would want to run through a lauter ton.
Mm-hmm.
So that those mash analyses are really relevant to people who are running lauter tons, and I think all home brewers are really running lauter tons than I'm aware of, or something similar to that. Fine grind is actually a flour. You grind the grain all the way down to a flour, and you make a mash out of it, and you get everything you can out of it. And it's representative of the yield that you might get if you were using a fine filtration apparatus like a mash filter, which is another means of solid liquid separation that's used by brewers. And that's one of the big reasons for having both a fine grind and a coarse grind is it relates to two types of common brewing equipment that are used by very big brewers. Then the as-is is basically, that's the malt as it is. That's what you would normally expect to get from a malt, whether it's coarse grind or fine grind, if you're brewing with it. The dry basis number is basically one that you generate from the original analysis of yield by just removing the effect of moisture. So in a finished malt, you might see the moisture fluctuate a couple percent, say from 4 to 6, or in extreme cases from, say, 3 to 7. As a customer, a large brewing customer, you could look at that and say, well, the yield is down. But then if you look at the dry basis analysis, you'd be able to say, well, actually, if it weren't for the effect of the moisture, which is off by a little bit, this would actually be malt that yields a very high amount.
Right.
So the value of that, of those dry basis numbers is, it's more used as a quality analysis tool for people who are trying to figure out if it's good malt or not, than it is really to be used as a
lot-to-lot comparison.
It's good for lot-to-lot comparison, but it's not good for predicting what your yield is going to be, because no brewer practically, bakes all the moisture out of the malt first before he uses it,
So that's one question I have is, let's say I buy a couple of sacks of two-row, and I store that in my brew shed in a trash can in a plastic bag. That's how I do it. And it starts out a certain point in moisture, and water being quite heavy, I imagine if it just gains a percentage or two of moisture over time, that's going to throw off my measurement quite a bit, right? So if I weigh out 10 pounds of two row when I first get the malt fresh from the maltster versus 6 months later after I'm living in sunny Florida where it's really humid and it's picked up a lot of moisture, then, you know, all of a sudden I'll see my efficiency drop, right? And how do I deal with that? How do I counter that? Is sealing it in a plastic trash bag effective enough?
Yeah, you know, Jamil, it's unfortunate that you have so little respect for your malt that you're storing it in trash cans and trash bags, but...
I actually sleep with it, but my wife got angry.
Oh, hey, well, that's more like what I do. So, anyway, but I mean, now you're getting really into a malt storage question, and the ability of the malt to pick up moisture from the air is really based on the relative humidity of the air in the area that you're in. So, yeah, if you're in dry areas, it's you can store malt really in a bucket with a lid, but if you're anywhere where you get higher relative humidity, say, really even above 30%, because malt is a fairly low relative humidity product, and you store it open, it can pick up moisture from the air. And when it does that, it gains weight, right? So you weigh your recipes out based on a weight, and, you may look at a COA or an analysis of this malt. Well, if the malt picks up 3 or 4% or maybe 5% moisture because you're living in Louisiana and, like you said, storing it in the open, you will lose that much, basically, to figure it out, you would divide by, you'd take the weight and basically multiply by, I think it would be 1 plus, you'd divide by 1 plus the gain in moisture. So, but in general, roughly you could say a 1% increase in moisture would roughly... reduce your yield by about 1% or about 0.8%. So, yeah, if you pick up 4 or 5% moisture, which is kind of an extreme case, you mm-hmm. will lose that much yield as well.
Well, because they dry these malts out fairly aggressively, right? And they try and get them down to, 4 or 5%. And some of these places in the country are very humid, very soggy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Florida.
Now, I can imagine you in Louisiana, like you're saying, that you could pick up quite a bit of moisture, enough to throw you off a few points in your Doppelbach or something like that, and wonder why this malt isn't producing so great, right?
Yep, really, what would happen with malt is that it will absorb moisture, and really this is true of any food product or anything. If you put it a low relative humidity product without a moisture barrier in an area with high relative humidity, it'll suck up moisture until it reaches equilibrium.
Mm-hmm.
Now, almost anything will spoil above 80% relative humidity. Above 80% relative humidity, you can basically grow mold on anything, on walls or anything. So,
mm-hmm.
But to give you an idea, so most grains are dried to 12%. Moisture, which is ends up being about 80% relative humidity. If a malt were stored at 80% or 70% relative humidity, fairly high relative humidities, without a moisture barrier, it would pick up. It would go from 4 or 5% moisture all the way up to 12, eventually.
Mm-hmm.
So, that could make a significant dent in what your yield is. So, big brewers. They'll have silos and they move their malt routinely, but a homebrewer who's got it in an open container is really prone to maybe picking up moisture and seeing some of those bigger variations. So, but Jamil, you do have the container might not be the most glamorous, you have the right idea. If you store something, a food product or malt in a moisture barrier bag in a sealed container, you wouldn't expect its quality to decline or to pick up moisture.
How long could we expect a malt to last in that kind of storage? A year, 2 years?
Well, shelf life or lasting is kind of a funny issue. If it was a good moisture bearer, you could expect it not to really ever pick up moisture. Malt in general, over time, as a seed who had sprouted and then been forced into dormancy, through drying, will start to lose some of its enzymatic power over time, even if stored nice and dry and cool. It will just naturally happen. So a general rule of thumb is if malt gets to be over a year old, it's going to start to lose its enzymatic power. Now, with modern-day malt, with its high enzymatic power, you're probably still good, unless you're doing a 50% adjunct brew or something pretty aggressive, to keep it longer than that. But in general, malt, you'd want to use it within a year.
One question I've had is, since malt is kind of
that's for enzymatic malt.
I mean,
the the specialty malts that are, you know, dark roasted, they're more like coffee. Their shelf life is, you know, almost infinite.
Okay.
Though their flavor might degrade a little over time.
And does moisture play a role in that? I've always had this assumption that the higher the moisture content, the easier something will oxidize. Or, you know, the moisture plays a role in oxidation. It's almost like a catalyst for oxidation.
Yeah, moisture does play a role in oxidation. There's a term. It's not just the moisture. It's really more the relative humidity of the product.
Mm-hmm.
And various types of oxidation are, you know, have minimums or maximums at different relative humidities. And actually, very moist products oxidize faster, and very dry products oxidize faster.
No.
So malt, you're lucky, is in an area that where, you know, it's kind of at a minimum.
Mm-hmm. One question I've had, Bob, is that, you know, since malt or enzymatic malt is kind of a living organism, does storing it in the freezer degrade it?
No, not really. It's probably better than, you know, other storage. In that, I guess I would say temperature's not bad, but I think, you know, that freezer storage, you get things like freezer burn, and it wouldn't necessarily be any better than cool dry storage, put it that way.
Oh, okay.
And it can suck the moisture out of things as well, right? That a possibility. I know the enzymes won't degrade for the temperature.
Yeah. But I guess, I mean, we're still assuming oxygen or moisture barrier bags, plastic bags, and so on.
All right.
Yeah, as long as you have a moisture barrier bag that's a good moisture barrier, it won't suck the moisture out. But yeah, everything moves to a state of equilibrium in terms of relative humidity. So if you don't have a moisture barrier bag, you know, malt will suck moisture out of anything. It's actually a very low, a fairly dry product. I mean, when you think barley or wheat flour or wheat, you know, normal grains are about 12% moisture. They're about 70% relative humidity. Malt at 5% moisture is, you know, it's below 30% relative humidity. It's actually a fairly dry product. So if you ever, you know, commingle or store or mix them together, they'll suck the moisture out and move to, you know, a relative humidity equilibrium.
See, this is why I love having you on the show. You know so much. Every time I've talked to you, you just blow me away with not only your knowledge of the science behind things, but how you've thought about how they apply to brewing and typical brewing scenarios. Not only professional, which I know you're very well versed in, but you seem to really pay attention to what the home brewers are doing. I really love that. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, I want to get into some of the other numbers on the malt analysis. I look at that, and there's a whole spread of them, and I wonder, you know, diastatic power or, you know, some of those other things. You know, what do they mean to us as homebrewers? We'll be back right after this.
Keep your carboy cap on.
This is Brew Strong.
We'll be right back.
What's good for the earth, good for your body, and great for your brew? Organic ingredients. This holiday season, the Organic Ingredient Experts Seven Bridges Co-op in awesome Santa Cruz, California, offers you the gift that keeps on giving to our planet. Sustainable, fair-wage ingredients to make the best organic homebrew you've ever had. There's a growing demand for organic products, and your choice to brew with them supports organic farmers worldwide. Brew organic, and you'll brew excellent beer that is free from chemical residues and genetically modified organisms, and you'll help contribute to a better world. If you're looking for organic ingredients, Seven Bridges offers a huge selection of USDA-certified kits and raw ingredients from 8 ounces to 50-pound sacks of grain, whole and pellet hops, and all the equipment you need. Seven Bridges, the organic homebrew experts since 1997. Visit www.breworganic.com.
Attention homebrew shop owners at Fermentap. They know you're tired of buying the same old gear that everyone else has. That's why Fermentap offers the newest and most cutting-edge brewing equipment known to man. Since 1998, Fermentap has been leading the fight against the boring and mundane by offering strange, unique, and just plain smart equipment. Like their stainless domed false bottoms. Never deal with the floating plastic hassle of other false bottoms again. And since they're made from stainless steel, they'll last a lifetime. Fermentap's line of copper wort chillers are the best on the market, designed to cool your wort faster and more efficiently than other immersion chillers. They actually invented the equipment to make these chillers not only work great, but look great too. How about a fantastic line of ingredients, including vanilla beans, sorghum extract, blue agave extract, hop bitterness extract, unique wine yeasts, green coffee beans, sake kits, all stuff you can't find anywhere else. Fermentap carries all the standard products and equipment you need as well, such as all-grain systems, stainless hardware, kettles, carbonation stones, you name it, they've got it. Fermentap's entire line of products has been helping retail shops meet the demands of their customers for nearly 10 years, and they want to help you too. For more information, see them on the web at fermentap.com or call Jason at 1-800-942-2750. Fermentap, better beer through innovation.
Did you know that every day a brewcaster goes to bed hungry? Did you know that that brewcaster is silently calling for the help of people just like you? Do you know that every day the unicorn and the rainbow have to blow sailors for loose change? For less than the cost of a half-calf, quad-shot, venti, extra-hot soy milk, triple-pump, hazel, low-fat foam, double-cupped macchiato a day, you can help starving adults in Pacheco. Your love can be felt for as little as 7 cents a day. Visit thebrewingnetwork.com/donate to sign up today for as little as $2 a month. Private first class in the BN Army. Buy your way up the ranks as corporal, sergeant, ranger, or colonel with an easy-to-do monthly donation that keeps brewcasters alive and your favorite internet radio station broadcasting. No donation is too small to help those in need. Can't you find it in your heart to share your love with a brewcaster? In return, you will enjoy the wealth of knowledge that comes with every episode of The Session, The Jameel Show, and yes, even that other show. Thank you for listening, and please sign up for your donation at thebrewingnetwork.com/donate today.
You're listening to The Brewing Network.
Back to the two guys that know how to turn beer into beer. This is Brew Strong.
All right, we're back. We're talking about malt analysis. And you may ask yourself, well, you know, why does malt analysis mean anything to me? Don't I just, you know, throw the malt in the mash tun? Or
why do
know,
I need to know this?
Yeah, you know, why do I need to know this? Well, you know, we've got one of the foremost experts on everything malt and even everything extract. And this guy, Bob Hansen from Breese, he knows everything extract and everything, you know, brewing with extract and brewing with grains. He knows it all. Award-winning professional brewer. And you know, one of the smartest people I know in the brewing industry. So we're very lucky to have you. Thanks, Bob, for spending some time with us and getting these things answered and helping out our listeners. So before the break, we had been talking about some of the things on the malt analysis, and I think I'm remiss here because usually we like to start off with kind of a definition of what we're talking about. I don't think we did that. What, Bob, what is a malt analysis? What is I see it. It's like a whole list of numbers. It's like a whole sheet. How do I get it? What does it mean? Should I look for it or should I just ignore it? What? Tell us about it.
Well, I guess I start where it's generated. A whole lot. When malt is made, you know, to make sure that it meets certain, you know, quality parameters designated by brewers, of course, we analyze it. And the analysis is basically a sample, a snapshot of the entire lot. Typically, it's an auto sample that generates everything throughout that, you know, batch or kiln, you know, whatever was made. And we run it through all the analytical tests that would be relevant to both brewers big and small, so that anybody who's interested in if this malt will perform the way they're interested, or the way they want, can look at that basically analysis, which is issued on the COA, and make sure it's going to perform the way they expect, or make adjustments if it's not.
Now, should my homebrew shop provide me this, or just if I ask them for it, should they provide me this, or not at all?
Again, we started to address that a little bit in the beginning. There are homebrewers out there that are just advanced probably as any of the bigger brewers that exist in terms of what they're expecting out of their system and what they want to be able to predict and control and the degree of accuracy they want in their recipe formulation. That said, the average home brewer really wouldn't be too concerned with a malt analysis sheet of a specific lot. As long as that lot was released by the maltster, it's normally guaranteed to be within the specifications that the maltster provides and perform as people would expect. Mm-hmm. Oftentimes, the thing that a home brewer would be most interested would be actually the analysis that's listed on a typical analysis sheet. And that's what they're most likely to see. Whether it's Breese or any other maltsters, all of us, normally on a yearly basis based on crop year, we'll issue a typical analysis for our malt. And that would be the average values that we expect our malts to fall into for that year.
So regardless of the crop year, Breese puts a lot of effort into adjusting their malting process and all that, so the final product is as close to kind of the center point of what you expect. So you can go year to year to year, and regardless of what the environment's doing, you're trying to keep it pretty close to the same. So I don't have to worry about it, is what you're saying. Look at it once for a particular malt you're choosing to use, but then trust the talent and science of the maltsters to keep it pretty close to center. Is that accurate?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And that's why most homebrewers can completely successfully brew and get all the calculations they need just by using typical analysis, not ever actually needing to consult the lot-to-lot variance. The lot-to-lot variance is really more important for, I would say larger brewers that are, to whom those variances can make significant differences in their, for example, their yields their colors, or in the case of, making an adjunct brew with 50% adjunct, small variances in the enzyme power they may want to adjust for somehow in their process.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What are some of the other numbers that we would see on a malt analysis sheet besides, the extract numbers we just discussed, which tell us, how much soluble extract, how great a rise in a gravity we're going to get out of a particular batch of malt. I noticed that I'm looking at a Breese malt analysis sheet right now, and it has protein, S/T, alpha amylase, diastatic power, color. I mean, what's with the protein and S/T there, Bob?
Protein and S over T, I kind of all relate to each other in that there's three actually numbers on there. There's total protein, there's soluble protein, then there's S over T. Okay. S over T, that is a soluble over total, is, and there's several of these numbers that are on a malt analysis sheet that are basically an indicator of did the maltster really do a good job of germinating this grain, and is it expected to give good performance, especially in abusive situations like high adjunct brewing. You have to realize that most of the grain and really even the malt analysis sheet that's normally generated by maltster is really tailored towards very large breweries. And that's why in the beginning of the show you asked me about points per gallon or things like that. From a home brewing point of view, that's the number you'd want to see on a COA. That's the analysis you'd really like to know. But unfortunately, big maltsters and even small ones, we don't report that number. We report, basically what the big brewers are expecting. And the S over T is a number that's used basically as an indicator of how well the malt was modified during the malting process. So maltsters, they want to really be able to look at that malt analysis and predict any problems that they're possibly going to have.
Yeah. Modification kind of drives how much mashing they need to do or what kind of mashing they need to do to get that extract?
It also has to do with things like how well things like non-starch polysaccharides like beta-glucans and pentosans are degraded. Oftentimes, okay, You'll also see two numbers on there. You'll see a beta-glucan number, and you may also see a wort viscosity number. And those, again, are maybe predictors of brew house performance. In the absence of those two numbers, though, you'll see, you know, S over T, which basically tells how, you know, if, and normally that number, a good range for S over T might be, say, normally you see it to be about 0.4. If it gets to be above 0.5, the malt is considered normally over-modified. If it's below 0.3, then it's really under-modified. And, of course, maybe you want under-modified malt or over-modified malt. That's a different story. Distillers, for example, want, you know, high enzymatic, fully modified malt. People who are, you know, want more of a European style may want slightly under-modified. But it's an indication of the modification. And to a normal homebrewer, what, you know, what does that really mean? I wouldn't say it really has a lot of relevance to them. Total protein gives you, and S over T also kind of give you an idea of where or why the yield in the malt is low. If you think about the two greatest factors that will affect the yield in malt, the first is the moisture. You know, higher moisture malts will have less yield, as is.
Right.
And the second one is the protein. If you take a percent protein in malt, you know, barley could easily vary from, say, 10 to 15%, you know, in a bad year for bad conditions, protein. That protein under normal conditions then is only, say, 40% soluble. That means 60% of its loss. So if you see the protein vary by 2%, that means your yield is going to go down 1.2%.
Okay.
So big brewers will very carefully look at protein, soluble protein, and then S over T. They look at total protein because they want it to be low, because higher protein is basically lost for them. They want a certain amount of protein because the protein ends up becoming the enzymes, so, but higher proteins are lost. They want low total proteins. Mm-hmm. They want soluble proteins that you know, will give an S over T to show that the malt's pretty modified, or, you know, about 40% soluble.
Well, I know that some European brewers, I was at the Craft Brewers Conference this past spring, and some of the European brewers were talking about they want a low-protein malt. They felt it had better flavor. Is there any story to that? Or?
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of things that go with higher protein. And higher protein, higher soluble protein, both those lead to higher colored malts. Well, actually, it's a soluble protein. It really leads to higher color malts through increased Maillard reactions. And color and flavor go hand in hand with the Maillard reactions that make malt. You know, we've talked about that a lot in the past. So, and you do see differences. And that's one of the differences between a 2-row and a 6-row. There's, you know, for specialty malts, the differences are smaller. For base malts or kilned malts, the differences are a bit bigger in that 2-row malts are lower in protein. They tend to have a cleaner, smoother flavor. You know, if you're trying to generate the same color with a low-protein malt, you'll kiln it at slightly different conditions, and, you know, the flavor will be slightly different.
Okay.
Now, whether it's better or worse is really a matter of preference, you know, and really what you know, somebody's trying to do with it. So.
It's the beer you actually brew with that, you know,
right.
Get that flavor. What about diastatic power? How does that, what's that, and how does that play into this?
Well, I mean, like, in general, you guys have been asking how does you know, malt analysis really relate to a home brewer. He'd want to know that he's going to get a good yield out of it. He'd want to see what the color is, because the color can kind of vary with enough variance that it may affect his recipe if he's really trying to be tight. And he'd also want to look at the diastatic power. The diastatic power and the alpha amylase, those are both measures of, you know, the enzymatic power of the malt. And if they get too low, it may not be possible to convert the malt under a normal mashing regime.
Yeah,
so
one thing
that are very important.
Yeah, I mean, I think as homebrewers, we tend to brew a wider variety of styles and use, and, you know, in some cases go overboard, but we tend to use more specialty malts, more non-enzymatic malts, than most big brewers, and potentially more adjuncts in a lot of cases than a professional brewer. And so the diastatic power, I think, is kind of important to us, where we're trying to convert a lot of starches such as, say, rolled oats, or flake corn, or maybe some of the more specialty malts. I mean, is that the case where we need to be more concerned about diastatic power, or is the diastatic power of domestic two row and so on, is that high enough that it's probably not a concern for us?
Well, again, it's normally based on that malt being produced by a maltster to their typical analysis and being released by their quality department. It'll be, two row will be fairly consistent, and year to year, batch to batch, we'll give brewers good results. The diastatic power is just one that, especially for home brewers, needs to be taken into consideration when they're all grain brewing. You're right in that smaller brewers or home brewers oftentimes will brew with more adjuncts. Now, those adjuncts may not necessarily be raw grains or flake grains or pre-dilatized grains. They may also be non-enzymatic specialty malts, caramel malts, high-temperature kiln malts, that have been like Munich 20s that have very little enzymatic power, and those may be a high proportion of their overall grist. So modern malt is so enzymatic that it's hard to actually control it, and people who try to control fermentability by controlling their mash temperatures are often disappointed in the degree of control they can affect, because the malt is so enzymatic these days that it just converts right away. The exception to that, though, is homebrewers a lot of times try to do very aggressive things, such as brewing a beer with 100% Munich malt, which can be done.
I do that.
Right. But when you do that, you need to pay attention to the diastatic power, because it can vary fairly widely on the 10 Lovibond Munich malt.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to want to try to get a lot that's higher on the end if you're going to go for 100%, and you're going to want to use step mashing and have good control. You can't just, go in and do a single step, high temp with any old malt and have that work out for you. It just won't convert.
What do you think a minimum diastatic power would be for for a situation like that where you're doing like 100% Munich? I mean, 30, 40, 50 in terms of the DP? Yeah.
Yeah. There's the DP and the alpha families kind of go hand in hand. And normally what I would say is you try to keep the alpha families at least at about a 50, and then have sufficient diastatic power to convert. The alpha is the one that's really going to you want to have a diastatic power of at least about 50.
Okay.
And then sufficient alpha amylase there to really get the job done too. So you got to kind of look at this. So if you look at like a typical Munich 20, it's only going to have, maybe a 20 in terms of the DP. And it's not going to have enough to convert itself at 100% usage rate. You're going to have to use something else. A typical Munich 10, you should be able to get somewhere in the 50 range or fairly close to that. And then if it's lower, you're going to want to modify your mashing regime to allow for that. That is, longer times at lower temperatures and definitely using step mashing.
That's what I was going to say. Is it just a matter of increasing time is your friend in getting these things converted, right?
Well, to a point, because, mm-hmm. You need, and I think, John, you've got some good graphs in your book, you need both alpha and DP to get the job done.
Mm-hmm.
Alpha is really kind of your workhorse. It, hacks and flashes at the starches and makes pieces so that the diastatic power can work. It is very possible that you can give it, a very long amount of time, and if it's at higher temperatures, you'll have deactivated the enzymes that you need. So to get the alpha to work effectively, you want to be at higher temperatures, but at those temperatures, oftentimes you're deactivating the beta amylase, or the total starch to grain power, which is measured by the diastatic power. So, I mean, one way to think about it is that an average mega brewer is limited at using about 50% adjunct, 50 to 60% starch that they're needed to convert. And a normal base malt then, used by these guys, a two-row, six-row, it's about, you know, 140, 150. So they're kind of limited once they get below, you know, if you do the math on that, you end up being, well, right around, say, 50 to 70.
I see. So if you got a diastatic power of 150, could have, you know, 66% adjunct or non-enzymatic adjunct, 33%, you know, 150 dp, and end up with 50 dp for the total, and that should
right. That
should take care of conversion.
And you should be fine. Again, the big brewers, they're trying to, you know, crank these batches out at, you know, 12 to 14 brews per day, so their conversion step can be limited in terms of time. Where you know, home brewer or small brewer, you can get as much time as you want, but practically, once that dt falls below, you know, your recipe average falls below 50, you really got to be careful in what you do. Above that, you can typically get away with, you know, various, you know, almost any mashing regime. But below that 50 dp, as a recipe total, as a recipe average, you run into trouble.
Or at least you have to be more concerned about it.
There are some things. I would say, you know, you start to get below 30 and you really, you know, you're talking like 4 or 5 hour mashes and you can start to have other problems. So.
All right, so we're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we're going to get more into the malt analysis sheet and all those interesting numbers on there and what it means to homebrewers and the quality of their beer.
Keep your carboy cap on.
This is Brew Strong.
We'll be right back.
Life is too short to drink shitty beer.
Do you have feelings of inadequacy? Do you suffer from shyness? Do you sometimes wish you were more assertive? If you answered yes to any of these questions, ask your doctor or pharmacist about tequila. Tequila is the safe, natural way to feel better and more confident about yourself and your actions. Tequila can help ease you out of your shyness and let you tell the world that you're ready and willing to do just about anything. You'll notice the benefits of tequila almost immediately, and with a regimen of regular doses, you can overcome any obstacles that prevent you from living the life you want to live. Shyness and awkwardness will be a thing of the past, and you'll discover many talents you never knew you had. Stop hiding and start living with tequila. Tequila may not be right for everyone. Women who are pregnant or nursing should not use tequila. However, women who wouldn't mind nursing or becoming pregnant are encouraged to try it. Side effects may include dizziness, nausea, vomiting, incarceration, erotic lustfulness, loss of motor control, loss of clothing, loss of money, loss of virginity, delusions of grandeur, table dancing, headache, dehydration, dry mouth, and a desire to sing karaoke and play all night rounds of strip poker, truth or dare, and naked twister. Warning, the consumption of alcohol may make you think you're whispering when you're not, is a major factor in dancing like a retard, may cause you to tell your friends over and over again that you're in love with them, also may cause you to think you can sing. Alcohol may lead you to believe that ex-lovers are really dying for you to telephone them at 4 in the morning. Alcohol may make you think you can logically converse with members of the opposite sex without spitting. It may create the illusion that you are tougher, smarter, faster, and better looking than most people, and it may lead you to think people are laughing with you. Alcohol may cause pregnancy, and it also may be a major factor in getting your ass kicked. So what are you waiting for? Stop hiding and start living with tequila.
Tequila!
Back to your hosts, Jamil Zainasheff and John Palmer. Putting the testicles in technical. This is Brew Strong.
All right, this is Bruce Strong. We're talking malt analysis and what it means to brewers. Our expert guest is Bob Hansen from Breeze Malting. And we were just going through diastatic power and a couple other things on the malt analysis sheet. I've been drinking a lot, so I'm not really sure where we left off. And, how you doing, Bob? Are you having a beer while you're doing this, or no?
Is that, yeah, he actually recommended that he did That I do when he calls. So I popped open an Imperial Hefeweizen here, which is real nice.
Well, we recommend that all our listeners drink heavily, because the show is much funnier and we are far more attractive when the listeners drink. Imperial Hefeweizen, is that your recipe, Bob? I think I think I recall that your Imperial.
We have a pilot brewery here, so our original recipe, but we definitely didn't invent the style. But I wanted to thank you guys too before we get off the air for calling me tonight, because the kids are just like cranked up on Halloween candy. And I'm supposed to be putting them to bed with my wife, but because I'm able to lock myself in a room and drink a beer and talk smart.
I gotta work. I'm sorry.
Sweet. Yep. Glad we could help. Let's see. Let's get back to the malt analysis sheets, I guess. So far, we've covered the extract, fine grind, coarse grind. We didn't really touch on the extract, fine grind, coarse grind difference, but that's pretty self-explanatory. That's the percent difference between the two numbers. And we also... Pardon?
If you wanted to, we can kill that one real quick too. That's also a measure of modification, similar to S over T. So each of those numbers has a meaning within themselves, and the fine grain coarse grain difference is a measure of modification. You like to see it below one. If it's if it gets higher than that, it can start to indicate under modified malt.
Because that means that. It means that you'd have to grind the malt finer to in order to have the enzymes get access to the starches, right?
Basically, and what that means is that then things like the non-starch polysaccharides, the beta glucans, pentosans, these things that are going to make it hard to get the extract out of the malt and potentially cause lautering difficulties, haven't been degraded. So. One of the reasons there's so many numbers on a malt analysis is that these big brewers are trying to find any number they can to predict brew house performance. And unfortunately, there's not a silver bullet number that will guarantee that someone's not going to have lautering difficulties. Each one of these is a little bit of a piece of one. So lower S over T needs, the malt was maybe under-modified and could give some problems, but not necessarily.
Okay.
Higher fine coarse difference would also indicate that the malt was maybe under-modified and may cause lautering difficulties. But again, not necessarily. There's not a single number, even things like beta-glucan, that you can hang your hat on to say that, this will definitively, at least within a certain range, cause me a problem or not.
So it's all just a list of indicators.
Yeah, and any of those, if they get way out of whack, something's really wrong with the malt. Because, here's a good example. You could get a batch of malt in that, just say 5 or 10% of it did not germinate, because it's a natural process, and for whatever reason, it doesn't germinate. So it doesn't grow at all, and it's, growing these beds. The rest of it grows great, but this 5% doesn't grow at all. And you can have malt with high enzymatic power, good yield, might look like it's going to perform very well in the brew house, but all of a sudden you have all these lautering difficulties.
Is an indicator of that phenomena, that would that be the mealy, half, and glossy number percentages?
Yep, that's another one that you see that's trying to indicate, how well the malt was modified. And again, you want to see... you'd like to see it all mealy. You don't want to see glassy, because that means that that's basically malt that did not grow. It's basically like barley, because barley is glassy,
So if you try to bite it, it'd break your tooth rather than bite in half.
Right, just like barley versus malt. So, all those are kind of indicators on kind of what was happening with the malt. A lot of the big numbers that you'd normally look at, enzymes, yield, things that you're really going to build your spec on, you could still have good numbers there and not have good brew house performance. And again, this is really for big brewers who are doing, 50% adjunct brews and trying to crank them out in, an hour and a half. So it's not quite as important, really, for a home brewer. really, again, mostly homebrewers are going to rely on the typical analysis. But here today, we're here to discuss all these things. So we'll kind of go into detail. And the fine coarse difference is really used primarily as an indication of modification and how well the brewer did their job, and if there's anything else going on there that isn't in the analysis.
Okay.
Because you could still, on a big brewing basis, we still, because here at Breeze, we've got a big brew house, we have a big 500-barrel brew house, we still get these mysteries where we get in, you know, malt that according to the analytical should be great, but, you know, the results in the lager ton, you know, beg to differ.
I see. Can you comment on how malt has changed over the last 100 years? I mean, you know, we hear as consumers, you know, we hear about finest Moravian malts and, malts used to be less modified and we need to do decoction or versus single infusion. I mean, does the malt analysis sheet shed some light on this for us in terms of making those decisions?
It would if you looked at, malt analysis over the years, for sure. And you also see it when maltsters duplicate maybe more historic styles, things like Pilsen malt or things like pale ale malt, where they're kind of using more traditional techniques. They may not fully modify these malts, maybe higher or lower kilning temperatures, you know, more traditional techniques. One of the things that most people aren't aware of, or you might not really think about, is that, you know, really, in the United States, there's certain breeds. There's a continual breeding program to make better and better malting barley. Malting barley is not such a great risk-free crop to grow that, you know, has a high economic advantage, and that's one of the reasons we've seen all the problems in the supply recently. Malting barley is a bit risky of a crop, so they're continually trying to go through breeding programs to improve it. Those breeding programs are really driven by a group called AMBA, the American Malted Barley Association, that's really driven, you know, primarily by the big brewers, who are looking for something completely different in their malt than small brewers. You know, big brewers want the highest yield and the most enzymatic power and the lowest price. And, I mean, the flavor's important to them as well, but those other factors are, you know, probably their biggest driving factors. So malted barley is continually made from varieties that change throughout the years and improve. But the standards by which they improve are really based on industrial brewing standards. They're not based on things like color or some of the subtleties of flavor, that might be important to a craft brewer or somebody making craft brew beer. So from time to time, you'll see one of the specialty maltsters may get in or start producing from a historic variety or something like that. But it's actually difficult to buy that barley because you need to realize as a brewer that maltsters, we buy barley, and somebody's got to grow that. And in order for the farmer to grow it, someone's got to go to that farmer and give him a real economic incentive to grow an old variety of barley that, you know, doesn't have disease resistance or lodges or doesn't have a good yield because they like the flavor better.
Yeah, I see.
That doesn't happen very often. Really, most of the malt that's made out there is really made to be turned into kind of industrial beer. So over the years, malt has gotten better yields, better disease resistance, but also it's been specifically selected for higher enzymatic power, greater yield.
Yeah, it's kind of like the hop situation too, where modern hop farms are trying to plant alpha. They're trying to, you know, get more alpha yield per acre because that's money to them.
Exactly.
And you know, we're getting away from some of these historic varieties like Saaz and Hallertau, which don't have as much yield per acre, may have very desirable aromas that craft brewers are looking for, but in terms of the big brewers, they just want alpha. They don't care so much about, you know, the specific aromas that a craft brewer might be looking for. And I can see where the same thing is happening in barley, where we're getting away from some of these older varieties that may have a little more character to them as we go to a larger yield.
Well, let me get on my soapbox here. You know, this is why when somebody has something that's, you know, 25 cents more per pound, and it's a, you know, a product that's going to provide better flavor in your beer, it's worth paying a few extra cents. It's like, you know, supporting those companies that support you know, craft beer and those companies that you know, in your local homebrew shop and all that. Well worth supporting. It may be a couple extra bucks per per batch of beer, but you know, well worth it. Don't skimp on it. You know, the malt is important.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, without a doubt. And I would say that, you know, price does not necessarily guarantee you quality, but if you're getting something really unique, you know, you may have to, and I'm sure you probably will have to pay a higher price for it.
Well,
there's
let me...
a lot of things as maltsters we could do and we'd like to do for brewers, mm-hmm. but, you know, we can't make enough at the premium enough to pay a farmer to grow a breed that, you know, isn't going to yield a profit for him. He's, you know, so it's got to carry all the way through the chain and work for everybody. And oftentimes, to get quality, you have to pay for that. So,
well, let me bust your chops over something you don't control. And but I got to ask for my Australian friends: is why can't they get Brees specialty malt products at least in Australia? There's no Brees distributor down there. I looked on the web. You know, come on.
No, not in Australia. And we do sell internationally, but specialty malts, there's some good specialty malt producers in Australia. So
yeah, but you guys produce a couple of unique things that I think you know, people around the world would really like to have.
Well, we produce a wider variety of malt than anybody on the planet, because, you know, we produce organic malt, and we also produce 6-row and 2-row specialty malts. We're like a lot of European guys only do 2-rows, so we already make a wider variety, but we're just not economically competitive. And I mean, we'd be glad to ship a container to Australia to anybody who wants to buy one.
A container. How about a few sacks?
well, you know,
or buy me a plane ticket to Australia, and I'll load up my suitcase with just malt.
Yeah, well, just gotta tell John Preston to order a container.
I mean, any of the, you know, Brees and any of the specialty maltsters, or most of them. You know, that's really what we do, is we take care of special needs, and you know, Australia is just not a market that we can be competitive in, just due to shipping costs. We also don't ship very much to Europe. So you will see some specialty maltsters, malts, even in areas where they aren't economically competitive, where they make something that's very unique. So, for example, smoked malt. You know, there's smoked malt. It's a great malt, and everybody wants to have it for certain recipes. But there's really only a couple that are commercially available. You know, there's a Wehrman one, and I think Chris makes one. Is a peated malt and a smoked malt, and they have very different characters.
Right.
So we're actually, this year, we're going to be producing a smoked malt as a limited one-time thing.
And I'll have to get me some.
We don't necessarily expect to make money on it. We're really doing it more to show our support of the industry.
Yeah, I like Brees as a company. I think you guys have the right attitudes.
Yeah.
And
It shows in all the employees. I've met Monica, and I've met Bernadette and lots of other people there.
And we're all brewers, and we love, you know, the industry, and we'd actually like to do a lot more, but, you know, there's limitations to it. Yeah. Rye malt is another good example. We make a rye malt, but we're looking at discontinuing it at one point because we make a rye malt has higher oil content, and after about 6 months, it actually will start to go rank.
So brewers out there, start making more rye beers?
Right. Yeah. Well, everybody loves rye malt. It's a neat malt. It's interesting. Yeah. But the problem is everybody loves it, but nobody buys
it. There's nothing to replace it either. I mean, if rye malt goes away, you're not going to be able to make those beers that you make a couple times a year that require rye malt. It's a big problem.
But somebody's got to buy it or nobody's going to make it. So, I mean, here we've got basically the smallest production malt house in North America, or in the United States at least. And we make one batch a year, which is 40,000 pounds a truckload, and we were having problems selling that. We make one batch every 6 months. We were having problems selling that before it went bad. And typically we were selling half the batch to cattle. because we couldn't sell it to breweries. So everybody loves this malt, but nobody buys it.
You know, that's a real shame. And, you know, when I went to Australia, I was reminded that apparently on one of the shows I said I would put a couple of bags, Ziploc bags of various malts in my luggage and take it down with me. And nobody reminded me of that. I honestly would have done it. A couple of, you know, Breese products. I would have put 20 or 30 pounds in my luggage because I don't bring a lot of clothes. T-shirts and shorts don't take up a whole lot. And I would have given it away. People are like, "Did you bring the malt that you said you'd bring?" And I'm like, "Nobody reminded me." And I drink heavily, so I don't really remember that. Hey Bob, I really appreciate your time. Can you stick with us through the break and answer some listener questions? Do you have that time?
I
know
no
we're intruding on your family time, so appreciate this.
No, like I said, you know, they're upstairs on a sugar rush. I think I hear them crying over the monitor, so I'm glad to be here in the shelter of this room. So, and, you know, you guys, we get together and we talk technical, and it may be, you know, maybe this is too high, so I'd love to respond to some listener questions.
Okay. We'll be back right after this.
Right. Brew smart. Brew strong. This is Brew Strong.
Hey, Push, the new brewery's looking good.
Thanks, Finn. Piece by piece.
Well, let's fire her up. Whoa! Is that a new kettle?
Yeah, just got it brand new, but paid half price.
What? And that blade scale?
40% off.
The new tap handle?
$5 instead of 13. Got a new regulator for the brew stand, too, but $5 instead of 25.
Dude, where are you stealing all this stuff from?
Where else? The more beer deal of the day.
Announcing the beer, and more beer deal of the day. Every day, a new fantastic deal from big items to small that will blow you away. Boil kettles, carboy carriers, sterile siphon starters, digital timers. Watch morebeer.com every day for a new deal, and you just might find the item you've been waiting for at a price you cannot believe. Hurry, because stock is limited on most items.
And that sweet Guinness cap, let me guess.
The more beer deal of the day.
Yeah, I knew it. Come on, let's brew something. Find the More Beer deal of the day at morebeer.com. Celebrity voices impersonated.
Hi, I'm Sean O'Sullivan, the brewmaster and co-founder of the 21st Amendment Brewery and Restaurant in San Francisco. 6 years ago, Nico Freccia and I opened the 21st Amendment on 2nd Street with the intent of bringing back the local neighborhood brew pub. Well, the neighborhood has really changed over the years, but the 21st Amendment still remains a great place for people to meet over a terrific meal and a tasty pint of beer. In the past, the only way you could enjoy the 21st Amendment's handcrafted beers was at the brew pub. Well, all that has changed. Now, the 21st Amendment beers are available in cans. That's right, cans. When was the last time you had a great beer in a can? Well, that day has come. We're offering our world-famous watermelon wheat and 21A IPA in cans. Cans are a better package than glass because cans keep the beer fresher longer, but you can also take cans to places where bottles can't go, like the beach, lake, golf courses, and sporting events. So join us in the revolution to take back the can from the big breweries and crack open a cold 21A craft beer in a can. The 21st Amendment, 563 Second Street in San Francisco, just 2 blocks from Giants Park.
Okay, I rolled a 15 and I get a +2 from my yeast starter.
Nope, sorry, you failed your roll. Your beer is infected.
No way.
You had to beat a 24. It's schizosaccharomyces.
This sucks. I just failed versus oxidation. Our party is fracked. Doug's the only one left and his beer is a Berliner Weiss.
What's this? A tea party?
Hey, this is a brew session, man. Get lost.
Is that an actual beer?
Yeah, I crafted it. I don't really use the dice anymore. I'm a 10th level beer nerd.
Are you a 10th level beer nerd? Does your significant other know the difference between an Irish red ale and a Flanders red ale? Do you burp, drizzle, spalt, and fart Y-Yeast 2308? Then you're in good company at Northern Brewer. Northern Brewer has all your beer nerd needs, ingredients, equipment, and knowledge 24 hours a day at northernbrewer.com. Plus, fast, cheap shipping, only $7.99 for the contiguous USA. And check out Northern Brewer's huge selection of dorky beer kits, including the socially awkward Patter's beer and the sci-fi convention. Showstopper number 8. Make 10th level at northernbrewer.com.
This is www.thebrewsnetwork.com.
Sit down next to it, grab yourself a paper towel, and watch those yeast have sex.
You're listening to the Brewing Network.
Back to the beer guys that make other beer guys look like wine guys. Brew strong.
All right, we're back. We're talking malt analysis with Bob Hansen at Brees Malting and my buddy John Palmer.
And hey, you know, we should tell everybody where Brees Malting is located. I mean, people may not know that.
In Wisconsin? No.
Chilton.
Yes? Yeah. Chilton, Wisconsin. See, I've been to the website enough that I think I know that. I'd like to visit.
They probably still don't know where that is because we're the county seat of a county with 30,000 people.
Well, maybe we pronounced it wrong. It's Wisconsin.
Exactly.
It's not Wisconsin. It's Wisconsin.
Yeah, we're just southwest of Green Bay there.
Ah, Green Bay.
Yeah,
put on the cheesehead. Mm-hmm. Go to the game.
Packers.
Go Packers. All right. I love that whole area. I love the people. It's kind of like Australia. Great people in Wisconsin. Yeah. That whole part of the country. Good, kind, solid people.
I got to tell a story. Back in 2000 when I first met Bob.
At John's Waffling.
Waffle on. I landed in Milwaukee, and Bob had provided directions on how to drive up to Chilton. And it was January, and there's snow all over the ground. It was like, 2 weeks after Christmas. And as I'm driving along, I'm listening to the radio, and like the Packers are on. They're in in the playoffs. And as I'm driving along, these country roads in Wisconsin, snow-covered towns and so on, you see the snowman, you see the inflatable snowman.
All with cheese heads?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But then you see the inflatable Green Bay Packers in every yard that I passed. I mean, there's Christmas lights.
It's a religion here.
And the Green Bay Packers, yeah, inflatable.
They're passionate people out there.
Yeah.
They're loyal people. You get to the big cities and the coasts, and the people out there are wonderful too, but I don't know. They lose some of that loyalty and dedication the hard work and I don't know. It's a different ethic. It's great people everywhere, but I appreciate that Midwest mentality.
Well, it's not like Southern California. I mean, it's pure basically for about 3 months. If you're outside for more than 15 minutes unprotected, you die. So there's a real motivation to work and be at work where it's nice and warm. Where, Southern California, it's like, hey,
that's true.
Nicer at the beach than at the office. So,
yeah, you can't fault those people either. It's like,
I don't know if it's genetics or the latitude or maybe it's the environment because
There you go. See, again, Bob Hansen. Very smart guy. I always learn something when I speak with Bob. All right, Bob.
You guys should come visit in February.
I've been to Minneapolis, St. Paul in January, I got relocated there for work one time and just spent a whole bunch of time wandering around there. Not so bad. It's a dry cold. People talk about that. I was there wearing, same stuff I wear in San Francisco.
Your nose bleeds for about 4 months,
In San Francisco, it's like 45, and I'm like my coat and my blue jeans stuff. I had no other clothes. Went to Minneapolis, and it was -4, and I was fine. I came back out to San Francisco. I was cold as could. We got a couple of people that work out there, that live out there, and they come out to San Francisco, and they're freezing. They're shivering. I'm like, why are you guys shivering? You live in Minneapolis where it snows all the time. They go, no, it's much colder out here. It's the moisture, the sea moisture, it just zaps the heat out of you.
It's that relative humidity. High relative humidity. It turns your body into a heat exchanger. Yeah, so.
Exactly. I got one last question for you before we get to the listener questions, which is, all right, so let's boil this down to a homebrewer malt analysis. Now, let's get, you know, low-tech, real simple. So we've looked at the sheet, and one of the things that I consider malt analysis is, before I brew any of the grains that I'm weighing out, I take a little taste. I look at them, I smell them, I take a little taste, I maybe try and squish them in my fingers. If they're mealy or something like that, I mean, what should I look for when I taste that?
Well, a taste is important because regardless of, you know, what any sort of typical analysis that we might provide, and again, I think that's really the numbers that homebrewers want to look at, is the typical analysis that are provided by brewers because, or provided by maltsters, because the specifics of batch-to-batch variability aren't as important on the homebrewing basis. But that said, those numbers are great, but nothing replaces tasting your ingredients because that's what, you know, those were the results when we analyzed it in the lab at our location, and who knows what happened to it by the time it got to you. I mean, there's a lot of great homebrew shops out there, and but, you know, things happen. So
there's a few bad ones out there, too.
Yeah, I mean, you should always taste your ingredients. I mean, if, yep. you know, if you find anything wrong, if, or if you're suspicious about them,
so
if
what,
they're really, I would say,
when I bite into the malt,
flavors,
when colors, I bite into the malt, what am I looking for?
Well, nobody, I would say, has ever replaced the value of the chew test. And this is true even of big brewers. They still do, besides just making warts from their malt, they also do the chew test. So look for a good flavor. I would also say, you know, look at the texture a little bit. Malt is a low moisture product, even the specialty malt. And when you chew them, you'd expect them to be basically slightly crunchy. If they're really soft, that may indicate that they picked up moisture and they're not being stored properly, or they weren't stored properly at some point in their life, you know.
What kind of off flavors could we look for?
I'm just, you know, musty, moldy, you know. Again, I think the biggest thing you need to look out for is, you know, people might be storing it in higher relative humidities. And not all maltsters, in fact, Breeze, our normal bag for malt is not a, does not have a poly liner. It's just a triple layer bag. So if you store it in an area that's 100% relative humidity while it's being transferred or stored somewhere, and it's there for a couple of weeks, and then it gets, you know, transferred to your homebrew shop, and they have it in the basement, and then they bring it up and whatever else, you know, I would say look for moldy, musty, any sort of off flavors. It should be clean and malty tasting, you know.
And crisp and crunchy.
Style. Yeah. And tasting black malt and chocolate malt, yeah. Off flavors there. Well, it tastes pretty bad. It's kind of funny because, you know, if you've ever tasted cocoa, it tastes like crap too. So chocolate malt, black malt. Nobody eats coffee grounds or chocolate malt, but you know, yeah. Or, you know, or cocoa. But you know,
but they're pretty stable.
Yeah, they're very stable, but and they're not as big of a concern. But, you know, I think any ingredient that you have, I think the best way to learn how to be a good brewer, and this is what I used to teach brewers when I was working in the pubs, is taste your beer all the way through the process. Taste your ingredients in the beginning. We just had a return, because at Breeze I also manage the quality department, we just had a return where the brewer tasted the ingredients, and they tasted bad. And then they brewed a batch of beer with them, and they tasted bad. And, you know, we ended up taking care of the problem, and we're not quite sure of what happened with the original ingredients. But we said, look, you know, if you taste it up front and it tastes bad, just we would prefer that you don't mm-hmm. brew with it and send us a sample so we can figure it out. It's same with, you know, homebrewers. It's like, when you know, one of the best things you can do, yeah, you've got that analysis, but you should taste all your ingredients. Mm-hmm. You should smell your hops. You should crush them. You should make sure that you've got, you know, good aromas and flavors there. And same with your malt, you know, throw a couple kernels in your mouth and see what they taste like. You should have a good, clean, malty flavor. It should have a nice crunch to it for specialty malt. Even for base malt, it should be fairly crunchy. If it's really soft and slack, it may indicate that the malt was not stored in the best conditions. Mm-hmm. It may have picked up moisture. If it has any sort of musty or grassy flavor, you know, don't use it.
I think that's perhaps the best advice that we've gotten out of this whole thing. I mean, all the other information is very interesting and useful, but I think that's, you know, kind of the key breakdown. And I know, you know, the folks at Breeze, quality products, but I know that their main concern is that the customers have make great beer from it. And if there's any problem, I know you guys have quality is I wouldn't say job one because that's somebody else's trademark, but you guys do a good thing there, and I'm really pleased to be able to use your products. All right, so we have some questions from the listener chat, Justin.
Yep, few questions, and just in case you guys haven't blown Bob enough tonight, I just wanted
Bob's
to point out
guy,
that Bob is one of the few guests who turned me into a listener tonight. I've listened to every word you've had to say, Bob. Thanks for being on the podcast.
Oh, really?
Yeah, you really... I don't pay attention to anybody. But, man, I can't stop listening to you. You really have a lot of information, so thanks. Let's see what we got from the chat for you, though. Here's a good question that came through. Somebody asked the difference between American and European malts. Maybe a good example of that is American pills...
Continental pills.
Versus continental... Something like that. What are the differences that we're looking at when we see those?
I guess American malts versus European malts. First off, in America, in general, you see, I would say, a lot more use of six-row malts across the board. It's more of the standard here in America because, a lot of our beers are high adjunct brews. And so the big maltsters are demanding six-row malt. And we also have the unique, kind of ability to make six-row specialty malts because six-row is the predominant malt here. We make six-row and two-row malts. So in general, between Europe and America, you don't see a lot of six-row malts in Europe. You see more in America. Then when you get to, specifically if you start to look at things like Pilsner malts and what are the differences between American-produced Pilsner and European Pilsner, there you got to start to look at, varietal differences. And if you look at a Pilsner produced by an American brewer, a Pils-type malt that's made to duplicate a European malt, using that type of breed of a malt and, using those malting conditions, so say making a slightly under-modified, low-protein two-row malt, that would be, more in the lines of what the Continental Pilsner is, you don't really see a lot of differences. Differences you might see would be, subtle differences due to climate. I think in general in Europe you'll see there's one or two malts that are actually unique because of, say, the seed choice that they're using. And that would be maybe the malting technique, so something like a Maris Otter. It's a pretty unique malt, and nobody in the U.S. is making something like that. But when it comes to just like a Pilsner malt, if you're getting a true, low-protein, two-row, under-modified malt produced kind of along that tradition, you won't see a lot of difference between American Pilsner malts, like the one we make, and what you see from Europe.
Okay. Here's another good question that came through from the chat. What standards, controls, or processes are in place to ensure that maltsters produce the same type of malt? And an example the listener gave was, if I buy C75 from one maltster, is there any coordination with other maltsters producing the same malt so that if we buy C75 from a couple places, we can expect the same thing?
Yes and no. Really, when you buy a C75, what you can expect is that you'll get a 75 Love a Bond because that's what they're specifying it. A lot of people produce them... there's a couple different techniques to making caramel malt. One is to produce it on a roaster, which is really what mainly all the Europeans are doing. And that's really what we do here at Brees as well. All our caramel malts are true crystal malts. They're produced on a roaster so that you'd expect every kernel to be roughly a little kernel of 75 Livabon malt, truly consistent all the way through, all the same color, produced in a batch. Also, here in America, there are some people that make kilned caramel malts. And so basically what they do is they just turn the heat way up in their kiln. Well, the kiln isn't a roaster that roasts a single batch in the course of a couple hours. It roasts a huge amount. It basically dries a huge amount of malt over the course of a couple of days. And it can't apply as high of a temperature, and it doesn't have good agitation or stirring, where a drum roaster is kind of like a cement mixer. It's constantly stirring, so you get a uniform product. Kiln-roasted malts are much less consistent. You'll get some that are actually mealy, some that are glassy, and they may be the same Lovibond rating, but the product will be different. So just because one maltster produces a malt doesn't mean that, you know, with a certain name or a certain number, doesn't mean that it will be the same across the board with different maltsters. That said, the question was really, you know, what controls do maltsters have individually? They specify their seed source, and it must meet certain parameters, and then they typically throughout the malting process control the addition of water. They control the temperature throughout germination to control the germination process, and then during the kilning or drying process, or roasting, which is also a drying process, they really control the relative humidity and the temperature so they can get consistent results.
All right. Another question is, I'm really glad you guys brought up at the beginning of the show temperature storage of malts. And one of the things that you kept mentioning, Bob, was if it really is a moisture protective bag or container that you're sealing it in. So what are we talking about when we say moisture protective? Somebody mentioned, you know, vacuum sealed bags. Is that what you're talking about? Are there other things we should be looking for?
Well, I mean, vacuum sealing is great. Normally, plastics, you want to get, and almost any plastic you're going to buy as a consumer is going to be, that's intact, is going to be an effective moisture barrier. But, you know, you're going to want to seal the bag with a twist tie or something that's going to, you know, allow it to seal, because even there you can get, depending on how you seal the opening to the bag, you can get air ingress. Really something that's going to prevent the movement of air in and out. And almost all bags would be good. Typical bags that might not be good are certain, grocery bags. Typically, they don't have, they're not completely non-porous.
Or like plastic grocery bags, you know, the...
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. They're not of the material that's necessarily going to completely prevent long-term ingress of moisture. Basically, the moisture barrier isn't as good. And then you also have to look out for, and certain garbage bags are like that too. Mm-hmm. But almost any plastic bag or pail that you can get a good seal on has a gasket that will seal, will be a good moisture barrier.
Well, and moisture is so much larger than an oxygen molecule. So a lot of the plastics are not very good at preventing oxygen. There's some, like the plastics that the food wraps are made of are good against stopping oxygen, but a lot of them aren't. But in the water molecules being so much larger, that also, I think there's a few more plastics that'll stop the moisture.
Yeah, and a lot of times it's a seam, and it's really only the really thin plastics in general that you really have to worry about, but, you know. Normal plastic, and even pails too. Pails may have a cover on them, but if there's not a gasket there, they're probably not sealing airtight.
Right. You can buy special buckets that have the screw-on seals, and they got the rubber gaskets and all those. They're a little expensive, but I imagine you put your grain in there. That'll store for years without a problem.
Yep, and very convenient too.
Someone in the chat right now is wondering if we can put our malt in condoms. Would that be safe?
Too oxygen permeable.
Okay, thank you, John.
All right, lubed or unlubed?
You don't want to interfere with the malt flavor, so I would say
those are designed to be thin. You know,
right?
Moisture barrier, but thin.
Okay,
pleasure for him.
I guess it all depends on what he's going to do with them afterwards. Yeah.
Another good point.
Some other intended use.
It sounds to me like you can take the same rule applies to your condoms as it does your plastic bags. If they're thin, probably not a good storage unit.
Don't try and interchange plastic bags and condoms. either use.
All right. That's it from the chat, but I do want to say they brought it like a mile. And Bob, thanks. Back to you guys.
All right. Let me summarize here. All right, so I think what we learned today is, malt analysis is important, probably more so for the mega brewers that are looking to shave, where it costs them millions, you know, when the analysis changes. And what the homebrewer should look at is, all right, you should definitely look at it at least once, you know, for the brand of malt you're using. And, you know, if you're going with the same malts, or if you, let's say, for example, you're buying Brees Two Row, you know, you can look at their malt analysis, and they're trying to keep it close year after year. They don't want to, you know, wildly change things, you know, because they've right. dialed it into the best possible product they could make, and they're going to try and keep it that way. So you can assume it's pretty close year to year, regardless of environmental factors. It may change, and you can briefly look at it every once in a while, but you're pretty close, and there's other factors in your brewing that are going to make more of a difference in extract and flavor and things like that
right.
than
process parameters
and the malt analysis. If you're doing a, you know, like 100% Munich mash, or using a lot of adjuncts, you want to look at the DP and see, you know, you got at least once you average everything out, you got at least 50 DP, right?
Right.
So if you got 100 DP, you can use about half adjuncts and still be around 50, and you may need to make some adjustments in time and temperature in order to properly make things convert. But generally, you're okay. I think most home brewers aren't going along those lines, but that's all right. And probably the most important thing is a taste test. So, yep. you know, the home brewers, or, you know, any brewer, you know, for my friends in Australia, the amateur brewer test is, you know, to take a taste. A few grains of everything you're going to put in your beer, and, you know, smell your hops, things like that. And should be crunchy, should be malty, should be clean, free of any sort of rancid or off
musty, moldy
type of flavors. And I've tasted malt like that before. I tossed it, and if you store your malt properly, uncrushed, you know, seal it from the air, moisture, things like that, lasts quite a long time. It's surprising how stable that stuff is. So try and store it airtight if you can. I think this is a real good show, and I really appreciate you being here with us, Bob, on such short notice. You, of course, were our number one choice for the show, so the fact that you were able to do it for us, we really appreciate. You were one of my favorite people in all of professional brewing.
Well, it's been a pleasure for me. So it's my first time. I think it was a bit too technical, but
No, not for our
yeah.
crew.
It's we put the what is it again?
The testicles in technical
yes.
or something like that.
I heard that on the ads. It was hilarious.
And are you going to make it out for the 2009 Homebrewers Conference in San Francisco?
I will. This last one was the first one that I missed.
Yeah, I've seen you.
Sorry.
I missed it too. I was dying of pneumonia, but it'll be good to see you out. And let me take you out to dinner or something and show you our appreciation just from the homebrew community.
Come to San Francisco. Jamil takes you out to dinner.
I'll take you out. Maybe a little waka waka waka.
What is that?
That's my little high-pitched porn voice there.
I see. Yeah. Good.
Bob has a great sense of humor, which is another thing.
All right.
Yeah, especially with that last caller, it's important.
Yeah. All right. Thank you, everybody, for listening. We are going to do another Brew Strong show right after this. If you're listening live, hang on, and we're going to be doing dry hopping with my good buddy, Tasty McDole, which I think the thing people don't know is he's very much into dry hopping, talks to a lot of pro brewers and a lot of scientists about dry hopping, and he's giving me the stink eye here. But he actually knows quite a bit about dry hopping and makes some great beers with the dry hopping. And don't forget, if you get a chance, you know, click on the various links and at the Brewing Network and, you know, get a subscription to BYO. Both John and I write for BYO, and you see us there every issue. And
that's right.
I do styles, John does technical, and, you know, well worth it. And if you buy it from thebrewingnetwork.com, the Brewing Network gets a little cut of the proceeds, and that helps keep us on the air as well. Get some shirts, get some glassware. I love the new glasses.
Some Brewing Classic Styles.
Brewing Classic Styles. Now signed by both John and myself, because John's here in the studio. He has to fly up for these shows. And so while he's here, we make him sign books. The whip marks don't really show on his back. You know,
I'm happy to do it.
Gave him a hoodie to hide the whip marks. But You know, he's doing it quite well. Anyways, we'll be back in just a few minutes if you're listening live. If you're listening on the podcast, get yourself over to thebrewingnetwork.com, and when we're doing the shows, it'll tell you when we're doing them live, and you can join in the chat and participate in the show live. Brew strong, everybody.
Take care.